So, I'm dead. Now what?
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 419 for the week of August 8th, 2022. I am the boy in the glass bubble, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Gargoyle Naming Dictionary, Sarah D. Bunting.
What about Genson?
Polar Dream Vortex, Tara Ariano.
Burr.
And 500-year-old drinking buddy, Elon Muscat.
I'll have the usual.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Thank you for joining us today. You've heard him on the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show. Spoiler, our first ever champion on that podcast. Right. You've heard him submitting an episode of The Simpsons to this very podcast. Joining us live for the first time, it is Elon Muscat. Welcome, Elon.
Woo! Elon! Yeah!
Thank you.
Elon is also here because he is a reader of 90s comic books. And when it comes to 90s comic books, The Sandman looms large. It is one of the greats. Finally adapted to the screen, a long gestating project. Netflix has turned it into a 10-episode series. Let's do the 10 check-in for the spoiler adverse. Quickly, Sandman, worth your time or not? Elon, what say you? Sarah D. Bunting, what do you think?
Yes.
Tara?
It's not for me, but if it's for you, I don't know, sure.
We like to go through the 10 check-in very quickly with a yes or no, but boy, I have so many qualifications that I'm just going to save it because I got yays, I got nays, depending on who you are and what your familiarity is with the subject matter. So let's just get right into the discussion of The Sandman. Elon, we asked you here because you are a fan of Sandman, and it's been a long road to finally getting this on the screen. You've watched it. Where do you think it succeeds, and where did it fall short of your expectations as a comic adaptation?
So it's a complicated question. I also have tricky feelings, but under the surface are expectations going back decades, not just to Sandman's missteps on the way to adaptation, but also on the way expectations have been raised and lowered by recent shows. I'm thinking Good Omens, which was a lot of fun, an adaptation of some game and stuff that worked well. I'm thinking another Goyer adaptation, Foundation, which was a less successful adaptation of an unadaptable work. So as they say, they raised my hopes and dashed them quite expertly. And then so I started The Sandman with very low expectations because I thought, how bad could it be? And with that in mind, every time it delighted me, I was so happy. It had all these little Easter eggs, little hooks that the comics paid a lot of attention to seeding. And as a TV show, to adapt it and keep all that in there while still telling a story that didn't put you to sleep every episode, that's no mean feat. So damning with faint praise, but there's more to it than that.
Yeah, I feel you on that one for sure. What did you think of Dream, the character, in that regards? Did they get that character right for you? How did you feel like he translated from the page to the screen? Because he is, of course, the central figure. He is the titular Sandman in this story. Mm-hmm.
See, it's interesting because if we're encountering Dream in the context of somebody who's read the comics a long time ago, we probably have this this built up feeling of a guy who does the right thing even when it's hard, you know, a sort of Jon Snow type. But then we've seen on TV that Jon Snow types are pretty drippy, right? And Dream is a bit of a guy who comes in, makes a deep and meaningful speech with his black text bubble, so everything looks much more serious than all the other comic book characters around him, and then proceeds to step on all the rakes. So to have a protagonist who is going to make every mistake and you still follow them, I think they captured that element of Dream. I just reread a couple of the first trades recently to be ready for the series and not have the pure light of nostalgia here. And it, it's hard for Dream to come across as completely likable. So with that in mind.
See, that's funny. I had the opposite take, which I thought in Dream in the comic books was such a giant dick all of the time. And, you know, I use dick flippantly. he is sort of a god. He has a god complex in the comic. He's much less likable to me in the comics, and much more indifferent than he is in the series to me, that I thought that, not that they changed him irreparably, but I found that I wanted him to have more of the uncaring menace that he seemed to have in the comic that lent weight to everything that happens after. And I felt like there was an effort to maybe make him a little more likable in the show. Not that he is a fun-loving guy that you want to have a beer with in the show, but I was a little bit surprised that I didn't have that same sort of, I see that Dream is still a dick feeling. So Sarah D. Bunting, when we were planning out our EHG episodes, you said, and I wrote it down because I thought it was pretty funny, quote, audible sigh, I can't with Gaiman. What is it about Gaiman that gave you that feeling? And surprisingly,
yeah,
I have to say that you said that this show is worth watching. So what happened?
I was shocked.
Between then and now?
I can't with Gaiman output. I'm glad Gaiman is in that David Lynch place for me. Mm. I'm glad he exists, even though what he makes is not for me. He was kind about TomatoNation.com when he didn't have to be, like a gazillion years ago, which was nice of him. But I have tried with Gaiman comics and just not. I think Stardust was the one that people were like, you have to. And I was like, I could barely get through it, and then had to sort of come up with not insulting things to say. Like, it's just not for me. So I went into this with absolutely zero expectations, which is super helpful in my Chen check-in assessment. Mm-hmm. I do think that for people who have no grounding in the source material, that this is actually, like, the pace is maybe a little stately, and I don't feel like it's possible to do a good rendition of Dream. My notes say Robert Smith of The Endless, like, mm-hmm. that's basically what you're dealing with. But I found this enjoyable to watch, like actor spotting. The baby gargoyle is just fucking shameless baby Yoda-esque pandering. It worked on me. It's cute. Fine. I'll buy the toy. And so I was surprised at how compelling it was. But I think this might be one of those cases where it's better if you sort of have an open mind, in the sense that you assume it's going to be super boring, that, and then you're pleasantly surprised even a little. Happier living through lowered expectations. I'm going to stitch that on a pillow, possibly in front of the Sandman. But, you know, I think it's very well made and watchable for people who don't know this world. A lot of that is down to the performances. It doesn't look cheap. David Thewlis, always a sign of quality, but it could just as easily be a thing where if you've never read the comics, you sit down in front of it and you're like, eh. But I assumed this would be actively off-putting, and it wasn't. So yes, sure, try it. But Neil Gaiman as a cultural figure is for other people, and that's fine. Not everything is for everyone, as my esteemed colleague Tara has said many times, and it's true.
Your comparison to David Lynch is very, yeah, I feel like you really nailed it there, as far as, like, you know, it is an acquired taste for mm-hmm. sure. Speaking about acquired taste, Tara, tell us about your love of the fantasy tropes on display on Sandman.
The one I wrote down was a line of dialogue that Lucien says to the Sandman, where she says, "There are rumors among the dream folk of a vortex." And it's like, that's too many things in one sentence. Like, I can't care about this. I'm sorry. And I don't say this to, like, ruin anyone else's. I said up top, this isn't for me. I don't like fantasy. You're going to hear a lot of this again in a couple of weeks when, spoiler, we talk about House of the Dragon, because it's going to be a lot of the same stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, this, you know, I don't know how else to say it. This just isn't what I, you know, vibe with. And I did watch more of it than Sarah. And when I say watch, I mean I was in the room when it was on. I spent I paid attention to the first episode. After that, I was making Melrose Place visual aids. So that was
can't
what I
confirm.
Spent the time.
We lost Tara after
two,
a couple episodes.
Two great tastes that something.
Yeah.
Will happen with.
And then when I finished the visual aids, it was like episode 9. I was like, I'm going to go put laundry away. And then I came back and saw the very end of the finale. So I get it. Like, I feel like I definitely took in more of it than I planned to.
Right.
But this is, it's just a lot of lore. And I feel like if you're not versed in that lore, it just feels, to me, it felt oppressive. It was like pushing me away.
Well, but let me ask you this. I don't disagree. I felt freed by not knowing slash caring about the lore mm-hmm. and being like, nobody expects me to like this, so something good could happen, and it sort sure. of did.
Yeah.
But did you feel, given the genre, that the acting core was doing a good job with the exposition and background, given how much of it there was and the sort of exposition, like... rumor from the fairies of a vortex. Like, ugh. I mean, I get it, but I thought that actor was good.
Sure. I don't know.
You're like, yeah, fuck her.
Okay. No, I don't have anything against anyone, but like one of the critiques that I read in some of the reviews was like, it looks like every other Netflix fantasy show. And it does. Like,
yeah.
It looks like The Witcher to me, which is the only other one of these that I've mm-hmm. like really interfaced with. And The Witcher has the advantage of like, super graphic violence, which this one didn't. So it's like, there's nothing here for me. But the worst part was that every time I tried to make fun of one of these jargony lines of dialogue, Dave was like, well, I'm sorry, it's not Married at First Sight. And I was like, all right, fine.
Yeah.
I guess I have no answer to that. I guess I'll just shut up. Back to...
It's no life after lockup. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I did understand what you were saying, because for me, that line that you were saying for me, for anything like this, and it's like Star Wars included, is like, you can see the proclamation of the prophecy of coming down the road.
Yes.
And
bam,
there it is. Like, my I'm not a crackpot challenge to writers is... Do that without saying the word prophecy or a synonym for the word prophecy and see if your story improves or not. Because as soon as you, like, prophecy is like one of those things for me that I put up there with time travel, body morphers, that just seems
DNA.
Like you could do a better job, a less lazy way to get where you want to go. Without saying prophecy.
Yeah, Dave and I also this weekend watched screeners of Star Trek Lower Decks season 3, and one of the episodes we watched is whatever, it doesn't matter. But they have a character that like has three sort of Star Trek-y versions of that in one sentence, and another character is like, that's too much, like that's too many things in one line. And that's how I feel about The Sandman, and that's truly all I have to say about it. So I will check out now.
For me, why I engaged with The Sandman was because I really, really enjoyed Gaiman's mix of mythology and sort of dark whimsy, I think is how I'm going to like nutshell The Sandman. He synthesized it in a way that was super compelling. For me, the best Sandman story was teased right at the end of season 1, and that is sort of like that second beat for the story of hell within the Sandman universe. What did you think of the stories they adapted up to the Dollhouse? And do you think that is the best Sandman has to offer, or are you excited for what's coming up?
Well, one thing I thought was interesting was that they didn't give you any more than you would have gotten by reading the comics, or give you any less. So they kind of took the same pace as the comics does to introduce all the little bits. And they threw in such little things like, you know, Barbie, Martin Tenbones, and the Arch of the Porpentine, right? Like all the little throwaway things. So if you, you know, if the prophecy of the vortex has thrown you off, then oh boy.
Yeah.
They were very selective in what they adapted, which is to say they were pretty comprehensive while leaving in all the little bits that are to come, like that conversation with that character at the end, teasing season 2, like the whole Lyta Hall arc, which, while it was sort of dissociated from its kind of DC Comics super entrenchedness in its original form, still had that character who will pay off if we get to season 6, you know.
I thought the efficiencies on how they changed the order of a few things to really accelerate where they were by the end of the Dollhouse run was actually really smart. I feel like they chopped off a lot of the fat, especially like with the Kincaid family kind of going back and forth, and you know, when the mother exits the story and stuff like that was very smart and saved themselves probably 10 minutes of screen time. I thought, you know, to be able to sort of take a second pass at your own work and not totally lucify it was actually pretty impressive. Like, I think Gaiman made some really smart choices and his team for what they tweaked. Like, they weren't these big changes, but they were really smart tweaks. And I did appreciate
yeah, that. it makes me think of an interview that Gaiman gave about how Game of Thrones made this possible. I think there are a lot of comparisons to make to Game of Thrones, where the first season, more than any other season, felt like a second draft of the original material. Like, hey, let's see if we can clean it up for people who aren't here for the prophecy of the Polar Dream Vortex. But at the same time, really just keeping the tone that the comic had about those individual stories. Like they made that 24/7 episode just as dark as the comic version without having some of the juvenile sensibilities and the splashy stuff, a little bit like the way The Boys was adapted. Didn't go all in on the gore.
With The Boys and with Sandman comic books, there's some edgelordiness to it that they neutered on both of them in their translations. And that was really smart choice on both of those, I think.
They kept the horror.
My big question, though, is why did the Sandman have to gear up in a special uniform in hell for his poetry battle with Lucifer? For me, that was the one moment where I'm like, this is so dumb that I've come around to loving it. So if you haven't seen it and you're still listening, there is a challenge in hell between Lucifer and Dream, and they both are sort of like personifying concepts that one up each other. You know, I am a dire wolf who does this and this, and therefore I am a hunter. And it goes on and on and on. It's like a kid's argument. Oh yeah? Well, I'm God. Oh yeah? Well, I'm the universe plus God infinity. And I'm infinity plus one. It's basically this argument, except he's wearing a special battle uniform, light leather armor from Dungeons and Dragons in order to have this poetry battle with Lucifer.
Mwah. Well, actually, as a poetry major. Just kidding.
Do you usually gear up for your battles?
I was sad for Dave's sake that neither of them was. I am a dark screen door creaking.
Oh. I did see in the Discord, early plug for the Discord, the thoughts on Azazel and how it looked like, you know, an effect out of Doctor Who, and how maybe instead of so many computer effects, maybe just throw in a few Muppets there. See how that works.
Yeah, that was surprising, because when he said his name, I'm like, well, how are they going to do this? Because in the comic books, he's just like a tear in space-time with Cheshire Cat faces all in it, all grinning at you, all sort of demonic. And they did just that. It looked so like first-pass composite that I was like taken aback. Like, there is being true to the source material, and then there is your Watchmen comic book adaptation too true to the material. It was really weird.
It was very Emily the Strange. You could see that on a journal sold at Urban Outfitters 20 years ago.
God.
For me, the best storyline is about to come up. So even though I was sort of like lukewarm on the Sandman, I definitely want to watch if they get to a season two with the tease they had at the end with Lucifer and the Hell storyline. Really looking forward to that. That is like my favorite part of the Sandman run.
The one last thought I had about the Sound of the Rings episode was for anyone who read the PSA pamphlet that they put out as part of a Constantine comic book with Death in the 90s, there was a lingering shot in that episode at the fruit stand on a bunch of bananas, and that I think is a nice little call out.
It is time to go around the dial. Our first up is with Tara.
Well, speaking of DC Comics characters that are the eponymous stars of TV adaptations about their exploits, Harley Quinn season 3 is currently in progress on HBO Max. This is the adult animated series that was originally on DC Universe for its first two seasons, but then that folded. The show moved over to HBO Max. It was co-created by Justin Halpern, who, yes, first became famous as @shitmydadsays on Twitter. But he has since had a very respectable career in TV. He's written on shows like Cougar Town and iZombie. He's an EP on Abbott Elementary. So I feel like the shit my dad says stain, as it were, has been washed clean. Dave and I talked about this show a couple of years ago after we sped through the first two seasons. It is, as you can probably guess, about Harley Quinn, Joker's sometime girlfriend, not anymore. She's voiced by Kaley Cuoco. He is voiced by Alan Tudyk, who also plays several other characters on the show. And there's a romantic journey over the first two seasons for Harley, away from Joker and towards someone else. I will not spoil who, even though it has been all over the entertainment press and season two ended more than 10 years ago, but still, I'm considerate. So season 3 is largely about that relationship and how to be a decent partner to someone while also being a supervillain. It's also about Commissioner Gordon, who's voiced by Chris Maloney. running for mayor. Andy Daly plays Two-Face, who is his campaign manager. We also see Batman, voiced by Diedrich Bader. He has to juggle his current Robin, who is Jacob Tremblay, with his former Robin, who has just returned to town, very angsty, rebranded as Nightwing. He is voiced by Harvey Guillen from What We Do in the Shadows. And some of the other villains in Harley's crew have cycled out, but she's still got Poison Ivy, Lake Bell, King Shark, Ron Funches, Clayface, Tudyk, and Frank the Plant, J.B. Smoove. I also think James Adomian as Bane has been in every episode so far. Not a lot. I respect how sparingly they deploy him because he is so funny as a voice and as a character. And the temptation to Kramerize him must be strong. So shouts to them for not doing that.
I also do appreciate what they're doing with Clayface this season.
Mm-hmm.
I always enjoy Clayface. And now he's sort this of getting, very, yeah. getting his chance at Hollywood fame.
Yeah.
There's this whole thing with Billy Bob Thornton. And then they actually get like James Gunn to come in and do this whole thing.
Yeah.
And I just noticed Cross's Twitter and a link today, and James Gunn is actually using his Clayface as James Gunn
yes.
in the thing as his avatar, which
that's
I thought
excellent.
Was great. Yeah.
It's
the best thing I can say about Harley Quinn. It's the smart kind of dumb. It's also super violent. I fear for his future in the Discovery era, although I just read today they are still developing season 4, so fingers crossed. There was also talk last week of the 10-year plans for DC, and I will fully admit, not everything DC has done in the past while has been great, but at least on TV, there's been room for weird shit like this and Doom Patrol and Peacemaker and the thought of them trying to tighten up and be more like Marvel, which feels sexless and antiseptic by comparison, is depressing. So watch Harley Quinn before it either gets boringly sanitized or canceled. Dave, did you have anything to add?
Just that I truly don't understand the dynamics of what is going on with HBO Max and Discovery Plus.
Well, we'll have more of this in the winner loser segment.
Okay,
yes.
All right, because it is trays confusing and mm-hmm. everything I hear about it sounds like a bad idea. So it's just like no matter which way it goes, it just sounds like bad news for everybody involved. So
yeah.
Good job on messaging there, giant corporation.
Mm-hmm. For my plug, speaking of shows that are ongoing that you should watch and are very worth your time, I reviewed season 2 of Reservation Dogs at Vanity Fair. This is another show that we've talked about in the past. It is an FX on Hulu show. So, you know, you have to have Hulu. Sadly, it is not on live, real FX, which is a shame. Although, you know, maybe not that much of a problem anymore now that no one has cable anymore except me and Dave and Sarah. But we'll link that in the show notes and watch Reservation Dogs. It's great.
It's a write-off. Elon, what do you have for us?
I just want to talk up Girls 5eva, which we've really been enjoying. Girls 5eva knows exactly when you have forgotten the stupid puns in the theme song. So every time they get to the end of the theme song and it says, "What are you waiting five?" My wife and I laugh so hard and fall off the sofa. It's been so much fun. Every video they do is stupider than the last. And 4 stars is something I still hum to myself in the shower every day. So, and the plug I want to plug is just that the Discord community for EHG has been really fun. It's been really vibrant. It's gotten me to think about Strange New Worlds and The Boys, which are 2 shows I enjoy just on their face, but with a group of people that are thinking about it a lot of time, sometimes deeply and sometimes superficially. So that's a blast.
I know which one I am.
Yes.
So that good times over there.
That's a perk for our Patreon supporters at any level of support.
Yeah.
So
it's fun. There's a really good group of people there. I enjoy it. Yeah. It's nice.
Yeah.
It's just like the right size. It's great.
Yep. We have fun.
Anything to plug to our listeners?
Could plug a couple of books. My sister-in-law, Fiona King Foster, has written a great, I don't know how to put it, like a kind of like a near future kind of gothic noir called The Captive. It is fantastic. So check that out. It's in the process of adaptation. So that's
Ooh.
Kind of fun too. And also a crime writer and good friend of mine, Sarah Weinman, has a relatively new book out called Scoundrel with an exclamation mark about a great wild political crime adjacent story that happened in the mid to late 20th century. And it's a real corker. So consider reading if you run out of things to watch on TV.
And consider buying it from Exhibit B Books because we will link it from there in our show notes.
Indeed.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes, the Exhibit B blog has a 2-part interview with Ms. Weinman from earlier this summer. Super fun to talk to her, so you should check that out. Speaking of crime, I am here to talk about Helter Skelter 1976, the famous original one starring Steve Railsback as Charles Manson. I will skip the plot summary. I had somehow never seen it before. I talk about being the last person to have cable. I'm also one of the last nanas to still have a DVD segment of my Netflix subscription.
Aww.
Which is the only way that you can watch the original Helter Skelter, except, like, you know, torrenting, which who would ever do that?
I would have put money down that they don't do that anymore.
No, yeah. They do.
I would have put money down that you could find it on YouTube, and you sure. can't. Like, yeah. You could probably piece it together in 3-minute segments, but...
Right. I was like, no, I found it, but it's the 2004 version, so never mind. Yeah.
But this is the weird thing about watching it. Like, if you do what I do for a living, which is review true crime and think about it, you have seen enough pieces of this that you're like, wait, didn't I write this up already? Didn't I watch it already? Like, you've just osmosed so much Manson material, even if you're just a, you know, normal person and civilian who's not like me, that you're like, this seems really familiar. And it's because it is. Like, this is the gold standard of Manson performances. The casting of George DiCenzo, who Law and Order fans will recognize as like a gangster Bunny Russo from Law and Order, as Vincent Bugliosi, is perfect. They really did look a lot alike. And I can't say that you should bother like tracking it down on DVD necessarily, but it does do a couple of things well. Nancy Wolfe as Susan Atkins has like that perfect just estrangement from empathy, sing-song delivery. It's really unsettling, even at this late date, you know, decades after these crimes and after the book Helter Skelter came out, that it's still like, she was not right in some way. Railsback is not, at first you feel like it's a little bit silent movie, this Manson, and then you realize that Manson himself was acting like he was in a silent movie to the world. That's how he sort of put over his whole con. And there's one scene in it that's very pretty businesslike, that does an excellent job translating, not exactly Manson's philosophy, because there's nothing to translate. It's racist claptrap and that's it. But translating why he was able to take the Book of Revelation, filter it through the Beatles' White Album, and get kids to believe it. And it wasn't just acid, like there was a sort of native lizard brain cleverness to it. And this scene between Bugliosi and Jason Ronard as Paul Watkins, I guess, is quite striking. So you don't have to bother with it. I watch this shit so you don't have to. That's the entire point of bestevidence.fyi. But if you come across it, if you are also a nana who still has a DVD subscription to Netflix and you have the capability of watching it at 1.25 speed or higher, I would advise that. Pacing can be a little stately, as befits a mid-70s miniseries. But there's some stuff in there that you're like, ooh, okay, like those bell bottoms aren't really 1969, but it for what it is, it's quite good. And given that it was the first of its kind, it's sort of surprisingly quality and empathetic to most of its subjects. And I don't exactly recommend it, but I'm not warning anyone away from it either. The Netflix DVD subscription, definitely warning you away from that, unless HBO Max just pulls everything, but, you know, we'll get into it. For my plug, my full review of this fine film will be at bestevidence.fyi in the next couple of days, along with a extremely unfortunately titled thing from Netflix called I Just Killed My Dad, which somehow is a three-parter, like, this is the life I have chosen. That's fine. You can read all of that on bestevidence.fyi, where Eve Beatty and I find the true crime that's worth your time. And, of course, true crime reading, exhibitbbooks.com.
I have been watching and thoroughly enjoying Light and Magic on Disney Plus. This is the documentary, first party documentary, mind you, of the story of Industrial Light and Magic, the Lucasfilm offshoot that does all the special effects for Star Wars et al. It is first party, so, you know, don't expect angry McGee to start dishing dirt on what a weirdo Lucas is, or
those crumb bums,
any of that kind of stuff. But it does really make you appreciate why Lucas is not considered an actor's director, because there's this like just these scenes where Lucas is like, well, movies are just like kinetic motion and everything else is just like whatever. It's like, great. What a great thing to say near actors. Episode one is all about putting the team together originally, and it's just like complete newbie chaos, and it is actually a really compelling story. The whole thing is written by Lawrence Kasdan, the guy who wrote Empire Strikes Back and Raiders of the Lost Ark. So it's actually got a really good narrative. It isn't just here's how they did the effects for Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back and, you know, Star Trek 2 and all that kind of stuff. There is a bit of nut and bolts in it, but it actually is more of a story crafted from all the people that worked on it way back when. Episode 2 gets into making the effects for Star Wars proper. Episode 3 gets into Empire and Jedi and when they opened up the corporation for other people like Spielberg to use. It is actually really good. My favorite little tidbit is from the third episode where you learn when they were designing Max Rebo, who is the blue elephant dude in Jabba's Palace, who's playing the space piano, that George Lucas
said, what is he playing?
Well, I don't know if it's technically jizz. It might be like an offshoot. You know,
space an offshoot of jizz,
there's definitely some jizz whalers in the band. Let's put it that way.
The jizz dimension.
But my favorite part is that when they were designing him and figuring out his vibe, George Lucas says, whenever you do the timing for the dancing, the song that you play on set is going to be Super Freak. So just imagine you're at Jabba's Palace and they're doing it, and what's actually playing is Super Freak.
Wow.
Frankly, it would have been better if they could somehow just like get John Williams to do like a John Williams version of Super Freak.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that scene would have been a lot better.
I just want to add, there was a recent Dish New Yorker article that's about Foley artists, how like the analog of art of Foley is still done by like people doing things. It's not computer generated mostly. And they talk to people from ILM. They're the main subjects of the article, so I'll link that in the show notes too.
It's so good,
fascinating.
That article.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, that is cool. What was the show recently? I guess it was Amazing Race, right? Where they have to go and there's like a Foley
That was
challenge.
Amazing Race. Mm-hmm.
That looks fun. I feel like that should be like on there with like escape rooms where you go in there and you're just like, here's the thing, do some like I would do that once at least.
Yeah,
go in there and do some Foley work for some guy's film.
Yeah,
it always comes up that they would use coconuts for hoofbeats, and every time that factoid comes up, which I feel like is the sort of level one fact that everybody knows about sound effects for like old time radio and stuff, I remember the fact that my brother technically is still grounded because my grandma was super unhappy that we thought grandma got run over by a reindeer was funny, so of course we were torturing her about it, and he went into the kitchen and used salad bowls and made clopping noises on the table and yelled, "Grandma, your ride's here," and my mother thought it was hilarious, but my dad had to ground him until he was 50, so 6 odd years to go. Good luck, Dave.
Gotta learn. Right here on the next Extra Extra Hot Great, we are tightening belts at HBO. Now that all this is happening, apparently they're just going to stop making shows. What? How much does that cost? What? Done. You're out of here. See you later, flight attendant. We are going to tell you how existing HBO and HBO Max shows are changing now that their budgets are being slashed. Mm-hmm. And then right here on the next EHG Prime, it is A League of Their Own with Liz Roscher. Don't miss that.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Kira D. It is TV games, and Kira writes, video game to TV adaptations are all the rage at the moment with Halo and The Witcher, originally a book, but let's not kid ourselves, and the upcoming The Last of Us series as some recent examples. But what about the other way around? Sure, TV shows like Star Trek and The Walking Dead have been made into games, but what about some less obvious series that would be fun to immerse ourselves in? Imagine, say, the Golden Girls role-playing game. What TV show would you make into a game? What kind of game? She gives some examples. And who or what would be the final boss? I'm going to go first. I have two. I've not really been a player of video games since Tekken times. My failure to beat the very final level of Tetrisphere on the N64 after trying for literally months, and Dave can confirm, is a shame that I carry with me always. But I live in the world, so I have a couple of ideas. And no, Dave, none of them are about sorting balls into vials. The first is Saul Goodman, Ace Attorney. I don't know anything about the Phoenix Wright series of games beyond the name, but I like the idea of a weird courtroom game where the dialogue is written in a style that sounds like it was translated to English from Japanese and is delivered by Bob Odenkirk, who I will add is someone who should do more voice work. I've been catching up on season 2 of the Amazon show Undone this week, and he's really good in it. We don't know the final boss in this one since the Better Call Saul finale is not until next week, but I'm going to guess mortality. And my second is RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars Party. When my sister Leah lived with Dave and me in Toronto, we spent a lot of very enjoyable evenings playing Mario Party, which was new at the time. It is spiritually a board game in console form. The characters from the Mario universe appear. You play a bunch of little mini games to earn stars, kind of like the just ended season of RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars. So I want a game where you can play as a contestant from the show and compete in video game versions of the challenges from the show, like putting on makeup, inventing TikTok dances, creating incredible looks for the runway, etc., and earn legendary legend stars in the process. Those are my pitches. Elon, what do you have for us?
Great segue, because my first pitch was going to be Super Property Brothers. but really, that was just for the pun. But then the idea took shape. I was thinking of those games like Dungeon Lords and the whole tower defense genre where you build something and then people come through and wreck it.
Yeah.
And my thought was the home restoration world could be a whole series, but start with maybe Restored from HGTV, where you take a house and try to get it back to its initial shape, and then a whole bunch of people come through and do their thing. So what's scenario one? Well, a family moves in and they got a bunch of dogs. Okay, scenario two is a bunch of kids throw their house party. And then at the end of the series of challenges, from the house that you've spent all this time restoring. And it's, you know, a kind of like one of those incredible machines, kind of like your building. You drop tiles, you build the level up, things come through and wreck it. And then the final boss is the real estate agent comes in and tells you what it's worth at the end of all of
it. I got a level for you for in between there somewhere, which is one of the series of foes or people that come into your house and want to put up like modern calligraphy, like bless this house signs and stuff like that. Lots of like bowls of twine ball.
Uh-huh. Oh, nice.
In this house we...
Sarah.
I also went with the Breaking Bad verse. Probably recency bias for me with that, but because it's so processy often about not only how its cons get run, but also how, you know, the legal sphere is kind of a con in its own way. I would like to see a game in the style of one of the old text RPG games of the 80s, like the Perry Mason trial game that I think David T. Cole and I jointly hallucinated because nobody else ever talks about it. you could play as Jimmy or Saul or Gene or Kim. You can pick from canonical cons/heists or other ones written and decision treed out just for this game. If you start to lose the quote mark, you can tap the Bluetooth headset button for advice, and you can collect the game equivalent of extra stars or lives or whatever as you play, and those can come in handy when you need like a quarter to call Mike Ehrmantraut for a cleanup op or whatever it is. This would likely be a nightmare to write, although at least you could cheap out on the design with the excuse that it's supposed to take place a decade and a half ago. You could probably hang it loosely on a frame from one of those CSI procedural games, although investigating and instigating aren't going to look quite the same on the breakout whiteboard. But I would play the hell out of this, and my idea of gaming is two dots, so I think there's something to it. Dave.
First of all, they really missed the boat not making a TV show out of the video game Team Fortress 2. That game's lore was actually super in-depth, had like a proper generational history story. It is really fucking funny. Like, they actually do like all these character introduction videos back in the day, like meet the sniper, meet the heavy, meet the pyro, meet the medic. And they're all really good. And the fact that they actually couldn't make a show out of that breaks my heart. There are so many weird little tidbits in there. Like, there's this Australian billionaire named Saxon Hale that is just like 14 macho, you know what I mean? He's just like He never wears a shirt, and his chest hair is in the shape of Australia itself. And he has one of my favorite lines from pop culture. Out of context, it's still great, which is, I like that lion's Tabasco. Uh-huh. Speaking to this particular extra credit challenge, my show that I want to make into a video game is The Gilded Age. Mm-hmm. There is a game genre, and I think it's mostly Japanese, of like dating simulations.
Yeah.
So I think you could take one of those game engines, which I would assume is like a mix of decision trees and like variable axis rating systems that affect character perception, like how wealthy are you, how charming, how attractive, like all these different criteria that your character is, and you mix it with some very Gilded Age metrics like lineage, what neighborhood you live in, what industry you're part of. And then I think you have a solid foundation for a game, which I am calling The Gilded Age Your Place, which is about, one, it's all things about your place, making your mansion the talk of the town. So it's got sort of like a property, Super Property Brothers element to it, where you actually have to dress up your mansion.
Yep.
Planning and throwing society events to raise your place in society. Basically, anything that the Carrie Coon character is obsessed with in the show is now you with a dating sim engine. So you have to impress the New York elite. You have to get them to like you. You have to fund the right things. You have to piss off the right people. You have to engage the other people. And it's basically just you moving up the ladder in society. That's my
Edith Wharton's The Sims. I'd play that too.
Basically. Yep.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
No canon this week, but I have a bonus loser for you, and it is me for forgetting to do this.
Let the wide stick give you the edge. Speed stick super dry antiperspirant.
The Sandman. Now, who has our winner of the week?
I thought it was going to be no canon, but okay.
Oh, yeah. Accept.
Let the wide stick give you the edge. Speed stick super dry antiperspirant.
No canon. And now the winner, Jeremy Allen White, my people, star of The Bear, risking cancellation, but running forever in my heart by accurately calling Chicago-style deep dish pizza, quote, disgusting. Mm-hmm. Heart emojis streaming out of my eyes. Love it.
Now, do you find it disgusting or just disappointing?
It's just not...
It's not pizza.
Like, it's not a thing. It's a pizza. Like, it's fine. I'll eat it. I've gone to Pizzeria Uno.
Right.
But like, I'll eat any pizza except New Haven pizza. Burning it on the bottom is not a thing. Sorry.
Okay.
Whoa. Bracing for all the hate mail. Don't bother. We don't care.
Yeah, I really don't. And I will fight you. Go ahead. Like, bring it on.
Yeah, we're not going to be argued with about it.
Just one of the many stupid things about Chicago, right, guys?
Chicago's a great city, but its pizza is ass.
And Loser of the Week?
We've already alluded to it earlier in the episode, but it is HBO Max subscribers. So everyone last week started going crazy when there was, you know, a call for shareholders, I guess, where the new president of HBO Max / Discovery was outlining his plans, and they all sound bad, but it's going to be combined with Discovery Plus and relaunched in summer 2023. As part of this, it used to be that HBO Max subscribers would get access via the platform to Warner Brothers theatrical releases 45 days after that's going away. And they also started quietly removing a bunch of titles, although it wasn't that quiet because it got reported. But Mrs. Fletcher, Here and Now, Run and Vinyl, all former Extra Hot Great Lead Topics, all no longer on HBO Max. So if you didn't catch that Tim Robbins, Holly Hunter, bunch of adopted kids show Here and Now that we talked about whenever that happened, now you can.
Is that the one that's like the 11/11 show?
Yes.
God, that was bad.
Yeah, it was real bad. So God. I'm not here to like, I mean, Mrs. Fletcher was really good. I think we all agreed that was a good one. And it's a shame that it's not around. And like, you know, that one wasn't, it was a limited series. So it wasn't going to continue either. The other three were bad, but it still sucks. And this is also why, just in case, I don't foresee a time when Sex and the City is going to be removed from HBO Max. But just in case we ever want to do anything with it on any other podcast that we ever have, I did go to eBay and buy the complete series DVDs for, no kidding, under 12 American dollars for like six seasons of the show. So yeah, just, you know, if there are any of your faves that you're especially concerned about losing access to, physical media is still here for you, and a DVD player can be yours for like $30.
Boy, so. This really feels like one of the last big pissing in the wind that is IPTV coming at you, the inevitability of just things being pumped straight into your home, and this guy's just like, no.
Yeah.
Theaters.
Yes.
Theaters. Gotta do it. But I just don't understand, like, there's all this, like, they're going to rebrand it different, you know, Discover Plus. Like, everybody loves Discovery Plus. Like,
yeah.
HBO has such a terrible name recognition, apparently.
In the world of television, like, oh, which is the leader in Emmy nominations again? I forget. The
whole thing is a mess.
It's dumb.
Yeah, well, speaking about being a mess and being dumb, do you know what time it is?
It's good time.
You get confused, Elon, when we start talking about all the streaming stuff, because in Canada, it's just like all in different spots and depending on whatever contract.
I have to translate it. It's like Back Bacon and, you know, Tim Hortons and, and which TD Bank is it? Yeah.
It's just ham. All right, guys, this is the sixth game time of the season. Our season scores are Tara with 3, Sarah with 2, value guests still looking to get on the board. Will the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show Season 1 champion put the value guests on the board this week? Let's find out. Today we are playing No Knack Hunting from Seth, who earns himself an extra credit topic.
Wow.
This game celebrates the worst of the best. I will provide you the title of the lowest rated episode of an acclaimed show, along with the year of its airing. You simply need to tell me the name of the show. All series are from IMDb's top 250 TV shows based off user rankings. So your mileage may vary on, you know, that whole thing with terms of quality. But
sure.
If you need a hint, we'll provide the name of the highest rated episode of that series. So 2 points from the lowest in the year, 1 point after the highest. I'm going to let you guess at both stages.
Ooh.
Here is an example from 2020. The episode title is Proper Preparation and Planning. Any idea what the show is there? 2020, this would be considered the worst episode of the series, according to IMDb.
Mm.
Highest rated title is Herogasm.
Oh, the boys.
Yeah, and that's how it's going to work. So, okay. All right, let's throw it to Tara for a steel meal sitch, please.
Hello. Sarah DeBunting continues to be our steel meal leader with 11. I have 7. Valued guests have 5 plus Eric's meal, and Elon is a listener, so I don't need to tell him how that works, but leap in fast if you want to steal.
All right, let's start with Picky to see who is going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, Sarah, Tara, Elon is our order. Are we ready to play No Knack Hunting?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
All right, here we go. Sarah DeBunting, we are going in chronological order, grouped by year. 1964 is the series. Worst episode, Sounds and Silences. Sounds and Silences, 1964.
1964.
Yes, and you can take a crack at the show without penalty.
Okay. I think it is Dark Shadows. Too early.
Best rated episode, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet.
Oh, Twilight Zone.
Twilight Zone is correct. To Tara, jumping ahead one full decade to 1974 for the episode Hamlet, rated the worst episode of this TV show, and name that show. Hamlet.
Charlie's Angels.
Best rated episode of this show is The Spanish Inquisition.
Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Yes, also good for 1. Elon, 1989, 15 years later. Worst episode is Shades of Grey.
Space, this is Star Trek The Next Generation.
You are correct. Yay! That is our first 2-point answer. Nicely done. Back to Sarah, also 1989. Worst episode is titled Superdome.
Superdome?
Superdome.
Under the Dome.
Little early for that. Best episode, Menos, The Hands of Fate.
1989, you said?
Yep. Manos, the Hands of Fate.
The Hands of Fate. I do not know the answer.
Steel Mill
from Elon.
This is Mystery Science Theater 3000, is it not?
Yes, it is.
God, 89, okay.
Tara.
Yep.
91. Worst episode is called The Dog.
Oh, shit. I feel like I know this, but I can't pull it. I'll take the hint.
The best episode is called The Soup Nazi.
Oh. The Dog is a bad episode. Seinfeld.
It is Seinfeld, yes. What happens in The Dog?
It's the one where Jerry, he's on a plane and the owner of the dog, like, gets sick. And Jerry ends up looking after the dog, who's, like, a terror.
Wow. I must have erased it from memory because it does not ring any
bells.
It's
very early, 91.
Elon, 1996. Jubilee's Fairy Tale Theater is the title of the worst rated episode of what TV show? Jubilee's Fairy Tale Theater.
Is this the X-Men?
It is the X-Men, the animated series. Yes. Want to guess what the best rated episode is? Also shares the title of a movie.
I'm going to say that's Days of Future Past.
Hey.
Sarah, next year, 1997. A Room with an Allen. A Room with an Allen.
Allen?
Yes. A-L-A-N. Allen, as in the name.
Allen. I don't know.
Okay, next clue. To Kill a Mocking Allen is considered the best. A Room with an Allen, the worst. To Kill a Mocking Allen, the best of what TV show?
Of what TV show? I do not know. It is not Benson. This I know.
It is not. It is I'm Alan Partridge. I'm Alan Partridge.
Oh,
Dan.
Okay.
Dan. Dan. Etc. Back to Tara.
Yeah.
1998. Terrence and Phillip in Not Without My Anus.
South Park.
Is correct. 2 points. Guess what the highest rated episode is, and they are correct on this one.
Mr. Hankey?
Nope. Scott Tenorman must die. All right, Elon, we're now in the 2000s. 2002. The worst episode is entitled Christopher.
Oh, my. Well, yeah. There's some backstory here, but that would be The Sopranos.
You are correct.
It's all true.
Sarah, would you agree with that one?
No, actually, but...
That's IMDb for you. What do you think the best one is?
Is it College? Pine Barrens?
Pine Barrens is actually the highest one.
Okay.
All right, Sarah.
Agree.
2 years later, 2004. Access. As in access granted. Access.
Lost?
Best episode of this series is called Two Cathedrals, according to IMDb.
Oh, The West Wing.
The West Wing, correct. Tara.
Yep.
2004, again. The worst episode of this otherwise good series, according to IMDb, is Can I Come Up Now?
How I Met Your Mother.
The best episode is called Everyone's Waiting.
6 Feet Under.
6 Feet Under is correct. Elon, 2006. We're in 2006 now. The worst episode of this show is called Black Market.
Black Market. That's Battlestar Galactica.
That is Battlestar Galactica. Is in fact the reason we have the Nonac. Mm-hmm. That was the very first Nonac. Best episode is Revelations. All right. Sarah D. Bunting, 2006 again. Leviathan Smiles.
Leviathan Smiles.
Yes,
oh,
that is considered
God.
The worst episode of this otherwise well-regarded series.
I don't know, so I'm going to guess Lost again. Okay.
Best episode is called Sold Under Sin. I believe that's in the canon.
Yeah.
Deadwood?
Deadwood is correct, yes. Tara?
Yep.
2007, Ladies' Room. Worst episode is called Ladies' Room.
Oh, no. I know this one, too. Hint.
Best episode is called The Suitcase. Madman. They're so mad. All right, take us into our score break for Elon 2007 again. The episode is called Bad Ideas. 2007.
I finally didn't get a science fiction show.
How do you know that?
Bad ideas, bad ideas. I don't know if they have titles like this. I just say Saturday Night Live.
Best episode is called Always. Always.
2007, Always. I'm lost at sea. I'm gonna say Lost.
I was waiting for that one. Incorrect. Anybody on that?
I would have guessed Lost also.
No, pretty generic titles for Friday Night Lights.
Oh,
all right. That is just almost halfway. Let's get the scores, please. Tara.
Sarah has 3. I have 6. Elon has 9.
All right. Elon is in the lead. Let's get right back to it. Lots of game love. Back to Sarah D. Bunting. We are now in the year 2010. The worst episode of this series, according to IMDb, is called Fly.
The worst?
Yep.
Okay, people are weird and wrong. Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad
people are weird
is
and wrong
correct.
About that episode in particular.
It was different. Best episode? Guesses?
Ozymandias.
Ozymandias, yes.
Yeah.
All right, fair. This is question number 17.
Spread Eagle.
For Tara.
Yep.
2 years hence in 2012. The worst episode is called Newsnight 2.0.
The Newsroom.
The Newsroom is correct.
I object to it being on a list of the 250 best shows, by the way.
Yeah, what the fuck?
This list is surprising me. I don't know how X-Men got on there. I love it, but how did it get there?
Elon, also 2012. Lisa Goes Gaga.
Well, I mean, it's hard to have a worst of late Simpsons, but I'm going to go Simpsons.
Yes, you are correct. It is Simpsons. Best rated episode. Any guesses?
Well, it's not the one I submitted for the canon.
Marge versus the Monorail?
It is not. That is definitely a contender for me.
Well, my favorite is Krusty Gets Canceled, but
it is not that one, no. It is the Grimes episode, Homer's Enemy.
Sure.
It's a good one. It's not the greatest.
The Frank Grimes episode. Make it clear. There is not an episode with Grimes as far as I know, but I'm sure it's coming.
Yeah, well.
This is question. 19. For Sarah D. Bunting, 2013. Worst episode is called Economics of Marine Biology.
Community.
Community, yes.
Nice.
2 points. Best episode, Remedial Chaos Theory. Tara, 2015. Alpine Shepherd Boy.
Oh my God, again, I know it. Hint.
Best episode is called Plan and Execution.
Now I'm further away. What was the year again, 2015?
2015.
New Girl.
That is incorrect. The answer we're looking for is Better Call Saul. Elon. 2015, I got a good feeling about your chances on a 2.1 here. Bear with me for how I'm going to actually read this one out. I'm going to give myself a little leeway here. Eps 1.3 underscore daemons dot mp4. There's a lot of number for letter substitutions in
that
there.
Bastard.
Oh, the only show with file extensions in the episode title is Mr. Robot.
Is Mr. Robot correct?
Well done.
Best episode is called 407 Proxy Authentication Required.
Ah, that was on the tip of my tongue.
Good old proxy.
All right, to Sarah. Also in 2015, Poor Little Rich Boy. And I have to say, this is probably the most Sarah-y show on the list.
Interesting.
Poor Little Rich Boy, 2015.
The Jinx?
It is Jinx.
What? I didn't know they had episode titles.
Best episode title, What the Hell Did I Do?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Belchy one. Yep. Sure.
Tara.
Yep.
2017.
Mm-hmm.
The Six Thatchers.
The Crown?
Mm. Shit. The, yes. right,
Oh, no, I still get another hint. Okay. Nice try, though.
The Reichenbach Ball.
Sherlock.
Sherlock, yes. Wood for one. Elon, 2017 again. Computer repair / psychic is the worst episode of this series, according to IMDb. The series is, however, in its top 250 TV shows. What's that show? Computer repair / psychic.
Psychic. This is one of those shows where the themes combine, and I'm so tempted to. I'll just make my guess, which is review with Horace.
Yeah, I love that guess.
That's a really good guess.
That's a really good guess.
The best episode of this show is called Finding Francis.
So this is Nathan For You.
Yes, Nathan For You. 1 point. Well done.
Build cannon pitch.
Sarah, 2017, worst episode titled The Kingpin Strategy.
The Kingpin Strategy. Narcos.
Narcos, correct.
Oh, hey.
Nice. Tara, yeah. 2017 again.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 7, The Lost Sister.
Hint.
Chapter 7, The Massacre at Hawkins Lab.
Stranger Things?
Stranger Things, 1 point. All right. For Elon, take us into our second heroic. We're nearing the end of our game. The Gang Beats Boggs, : Ladies Reboot.
Thanks, gang. This is... Well, I could be wrong, but I think it's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
You are correct. And with two questions left to go apiece, let's get the scores.
It's not close. I am in last place with 10. Sarah D. Bunting has 11. Elon has 16.
All right, let's get back into it. Sarah D. Bunting, 2018. This one should jog some recent bells. It is called...
Jog some bells, should it?
Did what I say?
That's what you said.
Jog
it
some bells.
Jog some recent bells. That's the expression.
Ring your memory. Sure.
I got to leave that in now. My stupidity amuses myself. I'm great. 2018 Shit Show at the Fuck Factory is considered the worst episode of this show.
Succession?
Succession. Yes, wasn't it Nick's cannon
pitch? Another failed cannon pitch. Sorry, Nick.
Well,
Tara,
yeah.
Also 2018, Open Casket. Open Casket. Considered the worst episode of this show.
Was Hannibal still on at this time? I'm just going to say Hannibal.
No.
Okay.
It's dark, episode, but I like it.
The Bent Neck Lady.
Oh, The Haunting of Hill House.
You are correct. All right, Elon, if you weren't going to win before, you are definitely going to win this one. With
and
this,
by the way, you were, but
yeah,
go
you
ahead.
Were.
Yeah.
With well, this layup.
Steel meal explosion, but anyway,
2019, worst episode is called The Iron Throne.
Yep. I'm sorry. That's Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones, 2 points. Best episode, The Winds of Winter. Sarah D. Bunting, your last question.
Your Winds of Winter.
I'll give you the Winds of Winter. Mm-hmm. 2019. Worst episode. Rachel, Jack, and Ashley 2. Rachel, Jack, and Ashley 2.
Rachel, Jack, and Ashley 2?
Yeah, T-O-O.
T-O-O. Yep. Okay. So there wasn't a Rachel, Jack, and Ashley : 1. I don't know. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend?
That is incorrect.
Good
the
guess,
best though. Episode, according to IMDb, and they are empirically wrong about this, is White Christmas. The actual answer is the best episode is called The National Anthem, but let's just go with
Oh, interesting. I don't agree on any of these, so Black Mirror?
Yes, Black Mirror is correct. Tara?
Yeah.
Let's fight about it.
2019, what is your best episode of Black Mirror?
I don't remember the... But San Junipero, I think.
San Junipero, for sure. Sure.
No. It's the pig fucking episode. You're all wrong.
That is kind of my favorite one, too.
This is my absolutely favorite. Like, not even close. It's pig fucking up here, and then, like, 2 miles below is something else. I don't know.
I do like the fake Star Trek one with Jesse Plemons. I think that one's
yes, great. I also like that one a lot.
San Junipero is not really a Black Mirror episode, and
no.
That's why it's so good.
Yes.
It's a life-affirming moment of joy.
Yeah, well, yeah.
That has nothing to do with Black Mirror.
That's not why I'm coming to Black Mirror. I wanted you depressed about the future. All right, Tara.
Yeah.
Last question. Mm-hmm. Also 2019. Kay. Chapter 5, The Gunslinger.
This fucking chapter bullshit. I don't know. Hint.
Chapter 16, The Rescue.
2019. God. Fear the Walking Dead.
That is incorrect. That show is The Mandalorian.
Oh, right.
Oh.
Last regulation question for Elon. Wrapping us up. Also 2019. Worst episode, Saving for Arraignment Day. Saving for Arraignment Day.
Good pun, but I'm going to need the hint.
All right. You are... I just ordered these by date, so I'm just saying. But your hint is development arrested. Best episode of what show?
So I guess the numbering restarted in 2019, but let's call that Arrested Development.
Yes, Arrested Development yes, is let's. Correct. Let's get the final score start.
Okay, I finished with 11. Sarah DeBenting finished with 14. Elon is handily our victor with 19 mm-hmm. points.
All right, nicely done. Let's well just done. Read you the tiebreaker. Also took place in 2019. First okay. person to shout it out wins the steel meal. Worst episode, according to IMDb, is called Maximizing Alphaness. Maximizing Alphaness. Best episode is called Optimal Tip-to-Tip Efficiency.
Oh, Silicon Valley.
Oh, God. Silicon Valley.
Yeah, Silicon Valley. Tara got that one first. All right. But today belongs to...
Valued guest.
Woo! Well done. Nicely done. Mm-hmm. Value guests are on Woo. The board thanks to Elon. Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We woke up well rested for our discussion on Netflix's adaptation of The Sandman before going around the dial with stops at Harley Quinn, Girls 5, Eva, Helter Skelter, and Light and Magic. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and this week's winner of Game Time was Elon. Thank you, Seth, for Game Time. Next up, HBO cheaping out on Extra Extra Hot Great, and the next EHG Prime, A League of Their Own. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Hong Shu,
Sarah D. Bunting,
nightmares seem to thrive here.
And Elon Muscat.
Check, please.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
The billion lords of hell stand arrayed about you. Tell us, why should we let you leave?